those are things that will end up saving Mother Earth. And so learning from us and collaborating with us, and also on issues of, we're still in COVID-19 and it's still severely impacting our tribal communities. So we're expecting them to work with us and helping us to bring the funding and the aid that we need, because $8 billion was not enough in the initial stimulus package.
We want to thank you so much, Ali Young, for being with us. Citizen of the Navajo Nation, organized throughout Arizona, is in New Mexico now, and founder of Protect the Sacred. And we will bring you Burton Warrington, Menominee, Potawatomi, and Ho-Chunk at democracynow.org to talk about the critical Native voter count in Wisconsin. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
Holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held. KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. And thanks.
There's so much that we need to share. So
this is KBOO Portland. It's Wednesday. It's 8:01 a.m. It's time for the Wednesday Talk Radio program with your host, Paul Roland. Stay tuned.
Carry it on indeed. Hello, everybody. This is Paul Roland. I have stayed home today to do my show. I've been coming into the station just to kind of get the feel of it, but I'm flying solo today, so I figured it didn't merit coming all the way down to KBOO and, you know, just playing it safe. So, I want to just thank Buffy St. Marie there for that song, and I want to thank Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez and the whole Democracy Now! Team for what they do, and for, in that case, uplifting Native voices. That's a theme we talked about last week on our show, me and my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, and a very important subject. And I want to pick up on a few themes that I've been covering over the months and years today. And as I said, I'm flying solo, so I'm looking for people to be ready to join in the conversation as soon as you are ready and able at 503-231-8187. I kind of like to think of this as a guided conversation with me as the, yes, host, but a facilitator. I have my themes that I think it makes a stronger show if people are able to, you know, keep with the theme and take it in various directions, but kind of build on the conversation. I think group conversations are a thing we don't get a chance to have a lot of in this culture, this society, and well, especially now since we're so separated, we don't have that many chances to get together physically in a room. So this is one place where we can do it, at least virtually. So yeah, I'd like to encourage people to if you can, try to pick up on some things I'm talking about and reflect it back to me, reflect it back to the community, and see where we can go. So yeah, I want to pick up on a couple themes. First, I want to talk about something that Amy mentioned today, which was resonates with something I talked about a few weeks ago, which was this idea, I called it a tale of two viruses, the ideological virus and the actual coronavirus. I centered it on the person of Donald Trump, who in many ways exemplifies the more virulent strain of this ideological virus of capitalist fake capitalist do-yourselfism, the idea of extreme individuality, in his case egotistic narcissism, which is again sort of the hyper virulent strain of that virus. The idea the prosperity gospel that I've had various people talk about over the years. In this case, I want to pick up on this thing that has made national, probably international news, that there's people who are actually going into the intensive care units, and some even going to their deaths, not actually believing, refusing to believe, not able to believe that they actually have the coronavirus. So that's an extreme case of these two viruses battling it out within an individual. So it's this one nurse from South Dakota. I haven't done the research to find out if other people are corroborating this around the country. It would be interesting to know if that's true. But this I'm taking this from a USA Today article from yesterday, which was, I guess, updated today. It's not real. In South Dakota, which has shunned masks and other COVID rules, some people die in denial, nurse says. And I'm just going to read some paragraphs. South Dakota's high rates of COVID-19 and low virus regulation have sparked criticism, even as some dying of the virus there don't believe it poses a real threat. That's according to Jody Doering, a South Dakota nurse who has gained national attention for her account of working on the front lines in a state where leaders have long minimized the impact of the virus and refuse to implement rules like mask mandates. I have a night off from the hospital. As I'm on my couch with my dog, this is a quote from her, I can't help but think of the COVID patients the last few days. The ones that stick out are those who still don't believe the virus is real, Doreen wrote in a Saturday tweet. They tell you there must be another reason they are sick. They call you names and ask why you have to wear all that stuff because they don't have COVID, because it's not real. Yes, this really happens. In an interview with CNN, Doreen said her description wasn't about a single patient. She tweeted about after her frustration boiled over as she recalled numerous patients whose dying words echoed the same theme. This can't be happening. It's not real. This is unacceptable by any standards. Dakotas are as bad as it gets anywhere in the world for COVID-19. While many patients accept that they are sick with the virus, the ones who do not will often lash out in anger and grasp at other explanations, suggesting they have the flu or even lung cancer, she said. Dorian said she often watches these patients' conditions deteriorate as she tries to convince them to say goodbye to loved ones. Other health professionals have accused South Dakota's leaders of also being in denial. You and the Dakotas, you knew it was coming, Dr. Ali Mokhtad, a professor at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, Seattle, told USA Today this month. You denied it. Even today, you're denying it. And it continues on for a while. Again, that's from USA Today yesterday and updated today. It's not real. In South Dakota, which has shunned masks and other COVID rules, some people die in denial, nurse says. That's quite a stark idea. Okay, so the other theme that I wanted to take up today is one that I've definitely talked about over the years, which relates to what's happening right now, these calls for unity from Joseph Biden in the face of what everybody agrees is an incredibly divided nation and culture. And you know, they're specifically talking about, I guess, the Trumpers and the anti-Trumpers, which in their own way mask so many other intersecting divisions that it might be helpful to try to understand a little better. So this idea of unity, what is it based upon? What principles and what values? It seems rather superficial the way it's put out. And over the years, as I said, I've talked about, you know, within what are the, again, these are very kind of shorthand for a very much more complex phenomenon, but, most people, we could say most people on KBOO identify themselves broadly as what? Liberals, radicals, progressives. Maybe people could offer some other ways to characterize it. But again, within that, it masks some real divisions. And that manifests itself both locally, regionally, and nationally. Right after the election, I'm going to be talking about a couple articles here. One is from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. When centrists lose, corporate media blame the left. It blew up in the national press soon after the election when a phone call within the Democratic caucus, I'm not sure exactly who it was spurred by. There is some quotes from some centrists. There's another word, centrist Democrats that were blaming the progressive wing for losses by centrist candidates, Democratic candidates for Congress. So the article from November 10th is when centrists lose, corporate media blame the left. And before I start reading that, there's another one. Did socialism and defund the police hurt Dems at the ballot box? That's from the website Cyber Disobedience. Then there's another article that refers to Portland from the LA Times, which I'm sure a number of you, maybe many of you, have come across in your Facebook feed or otherwise. Portland's anarchists say they support racial justice. Black activists want nothing to do with them. So to start out, when centrists lose, corporate media blame the left. And again, people get ready to call in. I also have a Facebook page, KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. That's KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio on Facebook. I'll be looking for your messages. And you can also call in at 503-231-8187. When centrists lose, corporate media blame the left. Joe Biden hadn't even been declared the victor of the 2020 election before establishment Democrats, in the face of poorer than expected results in House and Senate races, began pointing fingers at the left, with corporate media giving them a major assist. Democrats had been hoping for big wins on election night, with the possibility of winning not only the presidency but also the Senate, and increasing their majority in the House. But while Biden has come out on top, the party's most optimistic outcome in the Senate would be a 50-50 split if they win both Georgia runoff seats, giving them a majority with the vote of Vice President Kamala Harris. And rather than gaining the House, Democrats lost several seats. And there's still many, I'll add here, up in the air that Republicans are winning. They may come out with a razor-thin majority. And I understand there's actually some Democrat congresspeople who are up for cabinet seats, and I'm not sure what effect that will have. But that's a parenthesis. Let me continue with this Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting article. In the wake of these disappointments, the right wing of the party, they call it the right wing, some people call them centrists, immediately blamed its left wing for the poor showing, airing their grievances in a private conference call among House Democrats that was leaked to reporters. In a write-up about the call, the Washington Post's Rachel Bade and Erica Werner quoted and paraphrased 14 sources blaming those who, quote, endorse far-left positions for Democrats' losses, counterbalanced by only four sources defending the left. All of the progressive sources were named. Half of the establishment sources were either quoted anonymously, presented as unspecified moderates, or twice simply as Democrats, committing the exasperatingly common journalistic sleight of hand that erases progressive Democrats as legitimate members of their party. In addition to quoting a handful of participants on the call, Bade and Werner interviewed numerous moderates for the article. Several moderate Democrats said in interviews, that's a parenthesis, but only managed to interview two progressives, Alexandra Rojas, head of the leftist PAC Justice Democrats, along with Representative Jared Huffman, a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, who took the side of the centrists. And it goes on. In his piece on the dust-up in which Democrats traded excuses, blame, and prognostications, the New York Times quoted the South Carolina Representative James Clyburn, who, quote, cautioned against running on Medicare for all or defunding police or socialized medicine, adding that if Democrats pursued such policies, we're not going to win. What the article didn't mention was that Clyburn has taken more money from the pharmaceutical industry in the past decade than any other member of the House or Senate. And then it goes on at great length, and it's a very well worth article. I didn't actually prepare a program page, my bad, in which I would have given you the links, and maybe for those people go to the program page, be able to actually read up and prepare for this interview, something that I will try to make happen on a more frequent basis. But so yeah, that's what I've got on that. Again, did socialism and defund the police hurt Dems at the ballot box? That's, again, quoting from the same sources, Representative Abigail Spanberger, who was prominently quoted in the aftermath of that Democratic conference call, and Majority Whip James Clyburn, who we just quoted, say yes, while Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says no. The fight began when Spanberger, speaking on a Dems-only conference call with Speaker Pelosi last Thursday, went off against the notion, I guess that's probably two Thursdays ago, against the notion that Democrats did well on Election Day. Spanberger's first criticism was of the campaign to defund the police, the number one concern, and things that people brought to me in my district that I barely re-won was defunding the police. And I've heard from colleagues who have said, oh, it's the language of the streets. We should respect that. We're in Congress. We're professionals. We're supposed to talk about things in the way where we mean what we're talking about. If we don't mean we should defund the police, we shouldn't say that. Then she went off on socialism. If we want to talk about funding social services and ensuring good engagement in community policing, let's talk about what we're for. And we need to not ever use the word socialist or socialism ever again. Because while people think it doesn't matter, it does matter. And we lost good members because of it. So I will just say that she mixes a bunch of things together. Now, I think it's a legitimate discussion, the language that we use. Sure, of course, I think it some things can be off-putting. But to say that people lost because of these things is a stretch. And so I don't know. I'd like to know what you think, and then I probably should say something quickly about this other article, which refers to our fair city, Portland, from the Los Angeles Times of a few days ago. Portland's anarchists say they support racial justice. Black activists want nothing to do with them. I'll just have to get in a few paragraphs to give you the flavor. The day after President-elect Joe Biden delivered his victory speech telling the nation it was time to heal and unite, a clandestine Twitter account at Safe PDX Protest summoned Portland anarchists. Well, I should read a bunch of this because it kind of gives you the flavor of how they frame this. Meet at Laurelhurst Park at 8 p.m. and wear block and be water, the message said. That be water comes from the Hong Kong activists who kind of use the metaphor of being like water for how to deal with street demonstrations and not let themselves be cordoned off. I forget what the escaping my mind, but anyway, to not let themselves be cornered by the police and get beaten up and to not be so easily arrested, and to wear block. I think we all know what that means. The message said, calling for black garb and vigilance to evade police for a protest in solidarity with BLM, Black Lives Matter. The 50 or so people who showed up, I don't know how many people actually showed up, I wasn't there, nearly all of them white, looked like ninjas as they put on balaclavas, hoods, and scarves. Some carried gas masks. The call to action had declared no masters, leaders in the parlance of 19th century European anarchists. But the crowd huddled around one young man as he lambasted liberals for celebrating the defeat of President Trump while capitalism and the political system remain entrenched. They can show up to dance because of Orange Man Bad, but they can't be out here fighting with us, he said. So that's why we're going. I'm tired of liberal complacency. Word spread through the group that the target tonight would be the local headquarters of the Democratic Party. Somebody started beating a drum as a chant broke out, F Joe Biden. Then the anarchists marched into the upscale neighborhood intent on destruction. For months, Portland has been a significant face of the Black Lives Matter movement, in part because of the national attention that self-described anarchists brought to a nightly protest throughout the summer. They set fires, launched fireworks at authorities, and spat in their faces to draw them into violent confrontations that made headlines around the world. Now, there's so many things to say about the language that they're using to describe this, but I'll let you draw your own conclusions from that. The election of Biden has only antagonized the anarchists and exposed their differences with the black activists they claim to support. Again, that probably hides many, many complexities that aren't reflected here, but it does also represent legitimate divisions and tensions. Black activists and community leaders who generally view the defeat of Trump as an opportunity for change within the system said the anarchists are hijacking the movement and undermining the push for racial justice by continuing to commit violence. When people set fire to a building, it really does not liberate me one bit, said Mingus Maps, a black resident who won a seat on the Portland City Council this month. It does the opposite. It fuels the political culture that makes racism possible. And it quotes him some more, and it says, the anarchists believe working within the system is futile and say the political order and capitalist economy must be torn down. Biden, as head of a party supporting the free market system and private property rights, is no better than Trump, more than a dozen said in interviews. Well, at least a writer did do due diligence to actually interview some people. Distrusting the media, all refused to give their names, but pamphlets distributed a recent rally outlining their far-left philosophies. Abolish All Mayors, the title of one booklet, advocates the complete democratization and community control of all city bureaus and the abolition of the police. Why We Break Windows advocates an end to private property and invokes the Boston Tea Party to explain the point of political vandalism during revolts. Boy, again, this is a... It might get a little tedious for me to continue to read. Let me just, when I hear about somebody burning something down, I think about that as an act that's always been used against black people. Ron Herndon, a longtime black activist, said at a news conference the morning after, police use tear gas to disperse protesters firing paintballs. You are not helping us. It's a rather long article, and I'm probably doing it a disservice by not reading the whole thing, but I'm trying to strike a balance between giving you what these various writers have to say about what's going on in this being a talk radio show. So again, I have a Facebook page, KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. where you can message me, and I'll try to get to those. I also have a couple callers waiting patiently on the line, and we got George and James, so let's go first to George. Thanks for calling. What do you got to say?
Hi, Paul. Thanks very much. I was listening to alternative radio yesterday, I think it was yesterday, and heard a public health physician, I believe, who was interviewed, and this seems to me I'm wandering a little farther away from what you were just talking about, but he was interested in the attempts to explain the COVID virus epidemic, and he said there are so many other factors, including the homelessness, the hunger of many people who can't get enough food, can't afford it. And he mentioned other things, and I just thought that's a small contribution that he made, but it's a very important one, I think. And I don't want to take attention now away from some of the other things you've been mentioning. So I just wanted to mention that, and then I'm going to hang up and listen to the show.
Right. No, that's a perfectly appropriate point. I mean, the idea of underlying conditions that, you know, we heard, if you were listening to Democracy Now!, one of the Native American guests was talking about how in Native American communities, a lot of the underlying conditions, whether they're diabetes or whatever, tend to be more prevalent in, you know, heavily economically disadvantaged, large, you know, often communities of color, certainly poor people, who, you know, for whatever reasons in their lives are, often forced, often, you know, food ghettos and just, you know, a plethora of underlying economic, social, cultural problems that predispose people for getting these illnesses that, you know, add to the mortality rate and the rate of getting much more severe COVID. You know, we're talking about asthma because people live near polluting chemical plants and power plants, you name it, or live closer to the highways, or, you know, aren't able to buy, you know, $500,000+ houses that put them in, you know, exclusive privileged neighborhoods like Laurelhurst, for example, or perhaps the West Hills here in Portland. Yes, of course. You know, the intersectional approach looks at all these things, and so yes, that's a key part that the, you know, generally the right wingers and the hyper individualistic Republicans tend to, and the neoliberal Democrats tend to not to focus as much on the systemic nature of these things. So anyway, that was perfectly appropriate.
Thank you.
I could say
much
more, but we have James here. Hello? Oh, okay. I guess George was maybe still there and wanted to say something. I didn't mean to discourage him, but it looks like we got James on the line. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I just wanted to go over a few of the points that you brought up. First of all, the ideological virus versus COVID. What we have to really look at is that we've been dealing with 40 years of, you know, neoliberalism and austerity. And, you know, and this has continued through both Democratic and Republican presidencies, where the general overall condition has deteriorated because of the belief that if we unsaddle government from, if we unleash government from, I mean, unleash a business from government restrictions, that it would increase overall prosperity, which obviously it has not. And, you know, in talking about the prosperity gospel that you had brought up, you know, I tell everybody that the prosperity gospel is the religious sanctification of neoliberalism, meaning that it gives a religious justification for that sort of, like, well, you know, like, you know, rugged individualism on the right and meritocracy on the left, basically saying, well, God bless me because I'm better than you. you know, I'm there's something about me that is inherently spiritually better. So if you can fix that, then you'll receive the blessings. But, you know, like Chris Hedges says, you don't have to go to seminary to know that Jesus came, that Jesus didn't come to make people rich. And then in
which
terms
of course
of COVID-19,
goes
in terms of COVID-19, we have to look at it kind of like how we looked at the AIDS crisis during the Reagan administration and the type of rhetoric that surrounded AIDS, that even when people got it, that people believed it was the gay virus, or that, you know, like only black and brown people got it, or, you know, it, there was always this, it became more of a social stigma than in like an actual treatable condition. Which is what Trump started out as. You know, they call it the Kung Flu or the Chinese, you know, the China virus. So automatically it already put people on the defensive for feeling like they couldn't get the virus. Because they didn't fall into the ideological lines. And then in terms of Joe Biden, you know, what he's talking about for unity, what I think a lot of black and brown folks like us are thinking is that he's talking about tactical racial unity versus actual solidarity, which if you look through history, there are several instances of tactical racial unity, meaning that, you know, the white settler colonial bourgeoisie has used black and brown folks in a way to lift themselves up, but in every instance has left us in the dust. Probably the most relevant example would be that most people, especially at KBOO, since we all kind of fall along the socialist lines, would be like the IWW. The IWW was one of the last like real socialist movements, but even within their movement, they emphasized... Hang on a second. Door 55. They absolutely used us to get what they wanted. And so I think people are seeing the historical relevance. I mean, look about the way they used us in the election. I mean, black organizers organized outside of the Democratic Party, but still voted for the Democratic Party. And now they're saying that Black Lives Matter and socialism cost them the election. I guess in terms of the anarchists, the white anarchists, I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, you know, a lot of the white anarchists, while they mean well, they still live under the protection of settlerism, which is something that the white left has never really come to terms with, is that you can't be both settler and proletariat, you know, to use Marxist language. You cannot be both. Because in the times where they were one or the other, they benefited or was stuff was taken away. And then in terms of like Mingus maps, you know, we have to look at colonial bourgeoisie versus colonial proletariat. People like Mingus maps, people like Joanne Hardesty or even Edie Mondonet are all colonial bourgeoisie, and that they benefit from the structure of the system how it already is. And while I agree with him that the violence in the streets does not liberate them, what are they doing to address the issues of settlerism and capitalism? And that's what I put out to everybody else, because generally it's always like, well, it's an individual solve, that we don't need a revolutionary movement or revolutionary leadership. What we need to do is we just need to fall in line and then just hope we can get a little something.
Look, can I break in for just a second? Let's have a. I wanted just to not push back, but sort of not necessarily go in another direction. I just want to, while we're waiting for other people to call, 503-231-8187, this is a really good opportunity to. So we talked about the criticism of the language, you know, whether it's defund the police or socialism. I think a real problem, it is a real problem, because. I mean, something like settlerism is similar, because I think just people really don't have the conceptual tools, unfortunately, to understand what that means to be able, you know, because you kind of have to be able to, you know, there's the phenomenon of having to actually name something to be able to sort of be see that it actually exists. So you have to name it, see that it exists, to be able to actually possibly break free from it or work towards moving away from it, or dismantling it, destroying it, whatever you want to look at it. I think it's a real problem. You have to admit it. I think it's one of the things that does divide, you know, so-called liberals and radicals, or however you want to phrase it, is, you know, not just the language they use, but the actual, you know, conceptual framework that people operate under, which I've tried in my own little tiny way to sort of put out there that's we really need to be talking about that, and we don't much.
Well, and I agree. I agree with that, and I think the biggest thing that people need to realize is that first of all, we live in an age where we have unprecedented access to information. So I think there's a huge part in that, you know, we spend a lot of that time creating echo chambers, you know, whether it's in a personal basis or a community basis. And so that prevents us from actually learning about real ideas. And I think the other part of it is that if you look through history, this government has been very protective over what it allows people to learn. You know, the most enlightened working class was dismantled by this government because it was anti-American. It flirted with socialism, though it ended up kind of going with the settlerism. It flirted with socialism, and that was enough to scare them to have to break it up. And
yeah, I mean,
you have to start conflating Americanism with imperialism. You know, you cannot be both anti-imperialism but be pro-American, because being American is that a lot of our wealth is generated from the subjugation of other people. And, you know, and when we talk about socialism, it's never talked about in the way that it's always talked about as bad, kind of like the way the church would talk about witchcraft. You know, they'll say, oh, you know, whatever they don't like, whatever's right of giving money to the church and showing up on church every Sunday is witchcraft, basically. They don't consider anything within their church, such as, you know, drinking the blood and eating the body of Christ, is witchcraft, because that's just Christianity. So they don't see any of that kind of contradiction within themselves, but it's the same thing. You know, when we talk about socialism, they talk about Venezuela, or they'll talk about, you know, all these other places, but most people don't realize that the socialist governments that a lot of those places have were democratically elected, and they were used as a way to put down imperialism and capitalism. So in a way, they obscure the fact that it was capitalism and the suppression and oppression that was put upon them that they rose up and defeated it with socialism or communism in the case of the Vietnamese people, but then were re-subjugated in the name of freedom, which is just capitalism.
Well, let me just interrupt, and we do have another caller, so maybe we can wind this down. But so one thing I kind of wanted to get to, which is, you know, so what kind of unity is actually possible? You know, I've called for, you know, a liberal radical alliance, which is kind of like as vague and perhaps superficial as any other formulation. But, you know, there have been things like the idea of the popular front against fascism, the idea of a united front, you know, which an alliance of groups against their common enemies. A popular front is a broad coalition of different political groupings, usually made up of leftists and centrists. Mm-hmm. So again, it's like these are usually in sort of more extreme situations, like an actively, you know, a militarized fascist dictatorship, which is, you know, killing and jailing, imprisoning people or expelling people, and you actually have to meet them with force, which is what, you know, obviously I think a lot of the people ideologically, the anarchists, whether, you know, one agrees with their tactics or not, there's a lot we could talk about in disagreeing, but I think ideologically they feel that they're in that situation, you know, whether or not strategically, tactically, they're actually acting in a way that is more destined to bring about what their goals are is a big discussion. Anyway, this is a long discussion.
Well, I would just one more.
I think people, especially I'm talking to the white folks who are listening. I think you have to really understand the difference between tactical racial unity and true solidarity. Tactical racial unity is what Joe Biden, what he's calling for, almost kind of like a tokenism, not true representation. And to really give solidarity is to question, you know, not to restore the soul of America, but to understand what it really means to be American.
Okay, well, you've brought up a lot of great points. I certainly don't disagree with anything you said. I think many of the things you said obviously deserve a much fuller treatment than, unfortunately, we can give them, because I just like to respect other people's voices, and it's an hour-long show. But always great to hear from you, James, and thanks for calling in. Okay, what kind of unity? I mean, I had on a couple weeks back, the group that was calling for unity in the face of possible stolen election, which I must say, we can't completely discount at this point, because there's still, it does seem like the, and again, I'll just say, right, you know, I definitely am for, you know, the legitimate seating of the, you know, with all its horrible flaws and contradictions in our electoral process, I am in favor of the unseating of Donald Trump and the seating of the legitimately elected candidate Joe Biden, and obviously the need to do the kind of serious organizing. But anyway, there's a group in Portland. Someone can please refresh their name. I'll be able to pull it up soon. But that was, you know, organizing it, and we do need to continue organizing, because there are still some dangers in what Trump, both, you know, in what he can unleash, what he can do in terms of deregulation, in terms of dismantling parts of the bureaucracy that are actually functional and useful, you know, within, again, the contradictions of the nation state. But anyway, we got two callers, though, and you probably don't want to hear me continue. We got 20 minutes left, 503-231-8187. Let's go to Harry. You're on the air.
Oh, greetings, and thank you for taking my call. To go back to the coronavirus, this weekend there was a NASA rocket launch to the space station, and it was one of Elon Musk's rockets, but he wasn't there to watch it because he came down with the coronavirus. 4 days or 5 days before the launch, he tweeted or he contacted that he took a coronavirus test. He took four of them. Two of them he tested positive, and two of them he tested negative. So he was complaining about that the tests weren't really that accurate. But he still came down with the coronavirus.
Okay.
And I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, and considering what's going on. And one thing I've noticed was the news media, the local news, and sometimes the national, they don't talk about how many deaths per day. And I think this would, how serious this virus is, if people realize 1,500 people are dying a day around this country. I mean,
well, that was the yesterday's toll, which was definitely the largest amount in 6 months. It's gotten back up to that number, but it hadn't been. But yeah.
Yeah, but the majority of the news, like the local news, they'll talk about the Oregon deaths or the Oregon infections or the national infections, but they kind of leave out the deaths, and it's almost like collusion, because they're all doing it. They won't let people know how serious this is. 1,500 people a day. They're talking about in the next 2 months, by the time Joe Biden is inaugurated in January, in the mid of January, there's going to be 150,000 more deaths. Oh, no, sorry, 90,000 more deaths
Yeah. Well, I think most KBOO listeners probably know that. What do we do with that information?
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, like you mentioned, what's going on in South Dakota? Well, South Dakota, every year they have the Sturgis motorcycle rally, and of course
they were sounding. What can we do? I mean, these are important facts, but what do we take away from this information?
Yeah, no one's in control. I mean, Trump won on this area that we don't believe in the. He doesn't believe in masks. He doesn't believe in coronavirus. And look at all the people who have died. 15.
Right. No, that's true. And I think that's one thing that people are looking at a minimum to President-elect Biden to actually do what health experts said needed to be done from the very get-go, which was, you know, widespread testing, ramping up production of test kits, of protective gear, contact tracing, all that stuff, because it conflicts with their ideology, the Trumpists, the Republican Party, which has become basically Trumpists, refused to do because, again, it conflicted with their ideology. So we get back to this basic contradiction. So thank you for bringing that up.
Okay, one last thing. Thank you for bringing up Black Bloc. No one has heard from them, or you're the only one who's mentioned them through the all media who's causing the issues in downtown and the rioting. I don't know if you remember 3 or 4 years ago during the Women's March, they attacked, attacking windows and smashing things and everything else, and they ruined, they upended the Women's March. I remember they were all dressed in pink and they were marching downtown, and the Black Bloc, you know, just turned everything upside down, and they're doing the same thing too. And if the police would target them instead of Antifa, because Antifa wasn't really the one actually causing the riots downtown, it was the Black Bloc.
Okay. Well, that's a complicated issue, which on its own merits several programs. But thank you for that perspective, and I guess I could say my piece on that very briefly. Let me just let you go though here, because we have Karen who's on deck, and again we have 15 minutes left. So 503-231-8187 if anyone wants to weigh in. Before I go to Karen, the Black Bloc. I mean, I've talked about that over the years, the origins of it, how it. In the early origins of it, in the days of the, if people remember the just before the WTO, the so-called anti-globalization or global justice movement, it actually had an important role, and I think it still can have an important role. My problem with it they don't really try to. It is kind of a self-enclosed a bubble, as James was saying. It tends to be self-limiting, and it doesn't tend to. You know what I liked about the early days is they actually did have serious conversations across tendencies in the days of before 9/11 kind of blew everything up, so to speak. And changed the face of organizing. What was really a burgeoning grassroots global movement had kind of morphed into the. It sort of fell back upon a lot of the divisions. There was discussions between Black Bloc and unions and other people to sort of have common agreements, as Lisa Fithian has said and said on an interview I did with her a number of years ago. Where people actually did try to come up with points of unity, which is what we need to get back to, and which is why I'm calling for people to actually have discussions, because I think these where people don't understand the strategy and tactics of these, whether it's smashing windows or what in a particular instance, it just causes a lot of confusion. I think I'm not arguing against any tactic or strategy in particular. Can't particularly advocate for any, but anyway, I could go on and on about that. But let's hear what Karen has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Paul. Good morning, and oh my goodness. Well, I wanted to just point out that the so-called moderates blame the left when, in fact, the left helped them to win this time. And when, if we look at the cause and effect chain, we have to go back to the corporations, the ultra-wealthy, and we have to say, what conditions have they set up that people are reacting to? And, of course, being a socialist feminist since, you know, 1971 or 72, I am a socialist in the way that it would be a good thing. And I noticed that Noam Chomsky said we should not use the word socialist because it just alienates people. What you were saying was very good about people not having a clear understanding of what that means. And what that means for me and for Bernie and for lots of others is that we set up social programs that reflect the fact that the working class is bearing the burden on their backs and keeping the society functioning. So I just feel that what you said also, we don't have the consciousness, we don't have the conscious working class consciousness, so that people immediately look to what have the corporations and the wealthy done to us. Instead, they look to the scapegoats that are identified by the Trump administration to blame. And these are simple things in a way, but people believe in capitalism, even though, like in my hometown, it's been turned into a ghost town. It was a heavily industrialized town, and now in Ohio, and now it's the Rust Belt. And, you know, most people voted for Trump, and many people are on drugs there because they don't have work. So that's the tragedy, is that we don't have the consciousness of where these
problems. Can I just push back on one thing real quick? Robbie's on deck. James brought up an important point, and that my co-host Jacqueline Keeler also brought up about the term working class. Unfortunately, the way a lot of people use it tends to sort of, people think of it as a default as the white working class. And I think that James brought up historically, there's a book called Settler, which really goes into that in great detail, how the unions tended to be extremely racist and exclusionary of people of color. And there was sort of this idea of white working class unity. And I think that's broken up to a large degree. And you know, it hides the fact that some of the backbones of, you know, of unionism are actually African American, and in some cases Latinos, and the people who elected Biden, you said, you know, the left or whatever, but you know, a lot of it, there's a lot of organizing by African American women, and that you heard on Amy Goodman on some reservations by Native American women. Anyway, that's another, again, a complex issue that needs to be talked about. I just wanted to gently push back on, we need to, within the quote left, we need to also look at some of these things.
Tend it to be racially exclusive. I'm not talking about the white working class. I know damn well what African Americans, what immigrants, Latinx people, I know damn well what people of color and Native people have contributed. Right now, immigrants are bearing the brunt of horrible discrimination as they keep the food chain going, laboring in the fields, and African Americans have helped build this country. My extended family includes African Americans. I did not intend to hurt anybody.
No. I just think it's a conceptual thing that we need to. I'm not saying you in particular. I'm just saying that in the language that we use, I think we tend to we just tend to unconsciously incorporate some things that we certainly don't mean to. And I'm sure in your experience, that's not your experience. But
no,
I'm just saying that.
But it's good to know how it hurts people. Even though we don't, I have an old-fashioned vocabulary because I'm old. And I'm glad to know that this is a term that I cannot use, and just think that it will be okay for everybody who is hearing it. It will not be okay, and I thank you for pointing that out. So, yeah, we do need some kind of unity, and we do have to fight fascism, because, hey, that's what we have. So thank you so much, and thank you for the education. Have a good
thank
day.
Thank you, Karen. I'm not sure if I'm really the best person to be, quote, educating people on these issues. I sort of thrust myself into this position as a weekly talk show host, which, you know, I try to be somewhat self-aware of my limitations. And, you know, I just think working class historically has a lot of issues, you know, but again, that's such a complex question. And, you know, I don't necessarily come out of the, quote, working class myself. But anyway, let's hear what Robbie has to say about all this. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to bring up some things on the conversation with Antifa and the Black Bloc. Antifa isn't an organization, and Black Bloc is, you know, not also an organization, but also it's more or less a tactic. But at the end of the day, the rhetoric that I heard from the two callers ago, you know, complaining about the smashed windows and stuff, it's like, yeah, nobody likes to see that. But at the same time, you know, I hate to say this, but like, there is no other way of putting pressure on the system outside of that. Like, the people who remind us.
Well,
that,
wait a second. Oh, is that really true?
Well, let me explain, right? So, you know, Martin Luther King, the civil, you know, and I'm sure that person who was talking about, you know, a peaceful protest and all this stuff, you know, would always refer to Martin Luther King as a peaceful protester. But the Civil Rights Act was passed because of 7 days of rioting and looting after Martin Luther King was assassinated by the United States government. So this idea.
And how many people participated in those?
What was that?
How many? This is a really important issue, and we only have a couple minutes. The question is something building or is it not building? Is something truly a mass movement? You know, Black Lives Matter certainly attained the status of a mass movement, and within it, there was there was strategic property destruction. There was a lot of unstrategic property destruction. How does one distinguish between those? But I'm just on, you know, is the dynamic in Portland, is it building? Is it moving somewhere? Is it developing the kind of solidarity and alliances that we really need? I think that's a serious question that people need to look at.
Well, this is why I think it's such, you know, and what you bring up is the solidarity of it. Is like, are we going to be more upset about a smashed window and that, or are we going to be upset about the actual violence, which is what started and sparked these protests? And I think for us to determine which is more important to us is, you know, when we allow...
Well, I think you're making a false dichotomy there as well. I agree with that. I totally agree with that. But one but also can't be immune to criticism of one's tactics, one particular things that one does. Because you can't assume that as someone who's criticizing those tactics is not also very much against and working actively against the same things that you are.
Well, of course, but then you also have to listen to the oppressor. When you listen to the oppressor, they're saying the same exact things that these, you know, peaceful protesters want now. And I got to say, there is no such thing as, you know, there's this really interesting book that I think anybody who disagrees with me should check out. It's called How Nonviolence Protects the State. It's a very interesting book, and it lays out points. Again, it's how nonviolence protects the state. And basically what it lays out is how protest movements get co-opted, turn into this thing, and then lose their steam. Like with Occupy, we lost it because what happened was is the media started questioning, oh, why are we there? Why were we out camping in there? What is our message? And so the media was able to manipulate it. You know, BLM part two, not part one. Part one didn't have the media support that it allowed, which frankly, I feel like when Trump was in office, I think it allowed a lot more people to be open to protest. But then that allowed us to be more policed by the protest police, which the police are just the people that are upset that there's, you know, chaos and this destruction. But at the same time, when you're talking about building stuff, you can't just build over on top of something new. That's you know, the idea of that would be reform, and any civil rights activist knows reform.
No, I'm talking about building momentum in a movement. I'm talking about I've been part of at least a couple of movements in my life that took on a life of their own and became really important movements and actually achieved really real things. And I consider the Black Lives Matter, I consider No Dapple, those that I didn't participate in that directly, and I've seen others. And I just think these are important questions that people need to keep in mind. And I'm really nobody. I'm not really participating in them, so I don't unfortunately have. And I think a lot of people feel the same way. They feel like these things take place at night by people that they don't necessarily know. They're kind of, anyway, there's a lot of questions, and we can't go much further with it because we're pretty much out of time. And I wanted to go to Mike, but I'll give you one last thought, Robbie. Go ahead.
Yeah, one last point. The thing is you know how complex it is there on the street. There are people, there's saboteurs, there's provocateurs, there's people who aren't for it that are basically causing it, right? So we need to realize that that's going to happen until we address why we're protesting, not the other way around. We need to stop, you know, being like, you know, instead of looking at it like, oh, I wish they wouldn't break stuff, we need to be like, I wish they would fix the, you know, defund the police. Hearing the Portland police complain that they didn't get the entire increase of their budget, you know, which little bit we did, you know, try to defund them. You know, we need to stay focused on that and say, you know, if we had this mentality that like, look, you know, if this is going to be in the streets, then you need to fix this faster. When we all get on that page, then I think we're building something. Anyway, thank you very much.
No, thank you, Robbie. And apologies to Mike. I just felt like Robbie, just to be able to understand where that mini conversation was going, he needed to have a little more room. So apologies to you. Thank you for everyone who called in. Thank you for everyone who listened. Thank you to everyone who supports this wonderful community resource at KBOO. I've got to sign off, and thank you to Sonia for running the board. Bye-bye, everybody.
KBOO Portland.
You know what's great? Supporting your favorite nonprofit community radio station while getting a little something back at the